Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief, brought to you by Spoken Layer. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
Meet the real bearded Santas, trying to keep Christmas alive all year. By Ashley Hoffman. For dedicated professional Santas, representing the most famous merry man is a year-round gig. We're Santas 24 hours a day. Bob Callahan, 79, president of the Fraternal Order of Real Bearded Santas, Forbes, said in an interview, "If I go to the grocery store, I can't be off stage. Kids look at me, and they know." Created in L.A. in 2008, Forbes unites 350 natural bearded Santa impersonators for learning and networking events. Most of the members are retired from other jobs and find that appearing at malls, parties, and Christmas Eve stops as St. Nick is a rewarding way to supplement their Social Security checks. Impersonators in the Brotherhood call each other Santa first as a sign of respect. "All of my friends are Santa," Callahan says. "You have to be willing to live your life as this character." On June 17th, 75 Forbes members will attend the annual Christmas and June-themed Angels baseball game in L.A., clad in jolly red street clothes. Now the organization is working together on practicing original storytelling in order to get more bookings. Forbes Secretary Michael Wubker says that when it comes to home visits, families want a Santa who does more than a reading and a jingle bell sing-along. That means Santas are looking beyond the night before Christmas to spin their own personal tales with characters that leave an impression. Wubker came up with a backstory about his elf Murray at the North Pole, while another Santa carries around a chest of pixie dust that he tells children make the reindeer fly. Joining the Christmas community often starts with friends or family persuading a man to don the costume. "You're just an old guy with a white beard until you put on the suit. Their persona comes over you," Wubker says. Spreading joy in the proper attire can get expensive. An aspiring Kris Kringle can drop $1,000 on a red velvet Coca-Cola ad-style suits, buttons, and traditional white fur versions. They'll spend as much as $400 on thick belts with shiny gold buckle and fine leather boots, and most dye their hair platinum white regularly. The movie, The Santa Claus? It was fine until the sequel, when the big guy knew every kid's name, thus setting impossible expectations. "Tim Allen has given us a lot of tough moments," Callahan says. But he insists he can sway some non-believers as long as there is time to talk. And most kids believe. Off-season, children ask members one question. "Is it you?" Sometimes a wink goes a long way, Callahan says. How the radical 60s and 70s helped make Father's Day a national holiday. By Olivia B. Waxman. While Mother's Day has been a national holiday since 1914, Father's Day wouldn't get the same legal status until more than half a century later, when President Nixon signed into law a measure declaring the third Sunday of June to be observed as Father's Day. The proclamation acknowledged that it had already long been our national custom to observe each year one special Sunday in honor of America's fathers, and presidents had been making public statements of support of Father's Day since the early 1900s. Annual celebrations for dads date back to 1910, when Sonora Lewis Smart Dodd organized such an event to honor the life of her father, William Smart, a Civil War veteran and who raised six children on his own after his wife died in childbirth. But things changed in the 1970s. Experts say that one crucial force was a major shift in how the American father was perceived. The New Fatherhood movement developed in the early 20th century. In the midst of the temperance movement and concerns that urbanization was creating a generation of degenerates, as a growing body of research on child-rearing urged dads to support their kids not only financially, but also emotionally, from changing diapers to playing with them to giving them life advice, as Ralph LaRosa, the historian behind the History of Fatherhood Project, notes in Deconstructing Dads, Changing Images of Fathers in Popular Culture. As such, early iterations of the push for a national Father's Day often focused on validating the importance of the father's role in the family. For example, during the Great Depression, some saw Father's Day as a way to boost the self-esteem of men who had lost their jobs or had their wages cut, to show these dads they could still be there for their kids as a companion and male role model. Then, during World War II, when fathers were more likely to be away fighting, Father's Day ads showed images of dads in uniform and touted the role of father as a protector of home and hearth. LaRosa argues that the same kind of valorization of the father as protector, though not necessarily as a physical presence in the home, may have been happening in the late 60s and early 70s too, during the Vietnam War. Citing a section of the congressional record in which Montana Senator Mike Mansfield argued that Father's Day deserved as much recognition as Mother's Day got, because of the trying times through which Americans were living placed new burdens and responsibilities on dads. But Vietnam wasn't the only thing happening at the time. Another crucial element in the nationalization of Father's Day was the Women's Liberation Movement, which offered women a forum in which to fight for the same workplace opportunities as those men were entitled to. For some, the idea of that equality had echoes in the home. As parents started to split the tasks of parenting more equally, it got stranger that mothers were celebrated in a way that fathers weren't yet. What seemed to be different in the late 20th century is the belief that dads should take on more of the routine tasks of taking care of kids, like changing diapers, and to do it in the interest of gender equality, which wasn't as central a thing in the early 20th century new fatherhood movement, LaRosa says. For others, however, the desire for a day for fathers was more about a backlash to the perception of the father's place in the family slipping, suggests Timothy Marr, a professor of American Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. It was only after the sexual revolution and the establishment of the no-fault divorce in the 1960s challenged the prominence and permanence of the father's role in the home that Congress officially authorized a permanent observance in 1972. He writes in American Masculinities, a historical encyclopedia. Nowadays, while many parents are still working on mastering the perfect balance of gender equality in parenting in the 21st century, everyone seems to generally agree, thanks in part to the men's clothing industry, that dads deserve a token of appreciation one day of the year, even as Americans continue to debate what a father's responsibilities should be in the home. This is your reader, Lynn Foley. Happy Father's Day! Keep up the good work, guys.
7 U.S. soldiers wounded in insider attack by Afghan soldier. Associated Press, Kabul. An Afghan soldier opened fire on American soldiers on Saturday, injuring at least 7, the U.S. military said. It was the second such insider attack by an Afghan soldier in the past week. Abdul Kahar Aram, spokesman for the 209th Army Corps, confirmed that an insider attack took place at a camp in Mazar-e-Sharif. Aram said the soldiers returned fire and killed the attacker. General Dalat Waziri, spokesman for the Afghan Defense Ministry, also confirmed the attack. The Resolute Support Mission announced on its Twitter feed that 7 U.S. service members were wounded, but said there were no U.S. fatalities. It said one Afghan soldier was killed and one wounded. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid praised the attack in a statement sent to the media, but he did not claim Taliban responsibility. Last week, 3 U.S. soldiers were killed by an Afghan soldier in eastern Nangarhar province. In that case, Mujahid claimed that the shooter was a Taliban loyalist who infiltrated the army specifically to seek out opportunities to attack foreign soldiers. Judge declares mistrial in Bill Cosby's sexual assault case. Associated Press, Norristown, Pennsylvania. Bill Cosby, the comedian and actor once known as America's Dad for his TV role as paternal doctor Cliff Huxtable, avoided a conviction on Father's Day weekend as a jury declared itself hopelessly deadlocked on charges he drugged and molested a woman more than a decade ago. Prosecutors found themselves back to square one Saturday after the judge declared a mistrial following more than 52 hours of deliberations over 6 days. Excoriated by the defense for charging Cosby in the first place, District Attorney Kevin Steele vowed to put him on trial a second time, saying accuser Andrea Constand supported the decision. "She has shown such courage through this, and we are in awe of what she has done," Steele said. "She's entitled to a verdict in this case." Cosby's team declared victory, however temporary. By sowing doubt among one or more jurors, Cosby's lawyers managed to overcome 2 years of unrelenting bad publicity for their client after the public release of his damaging testimony about drugs and sex, as well as a barrage of accusations from 60 women who came forward to accuse him of sexual assault. Constand's 2004 encounter with Cosby at his suburban Philadelphia estate was the only one to result in criminal charges. She told jurors that Cosby gave her pills that made her woozy and then penetrated her with his fingers as she lay paralyzed on a couch, unable to tell him to stop. "She's ready to go again," said her lawyer, Dolores Troiani, of a retrial. "She's a very spiritual woman. She believes things happen for a purpose, and I think the purpose is it should encourage other women to come forward and have their day in court." Troiani acknowledged the difficulty of the case, given the passage of time and the impact of the alleged drugging on Constand's ability to recall details. The jury failed to reach a unanimous decision on any of the three counts against the comedian, ending the trial without a verdict. Cosby's team immediately went on the attack. The entertainer's wife of 53 years, Camille, slammed prosecutors for bringing the case to court, calling Steele heinously and exploitively ambitious in a statement released after the trial. She also criticized the judge, the accuser's lawyers, and the media. "How do I describe the judge? Overtly arrogant, collaborating with the district attorney," said her statement, which was tweeted by her husband and read by an associate of the public relations firm representing Cosby. Cosby himself didn't comment, remaining stoic as the judge declared a mistrial, but Wyatt declared the star's power is back. "It has been restored." That seemed debatable. Cosby's career and good guy image were already in tatters by the time his chief accuser took the witness stand, and the prosecution's decision to pursue a second trial keeps him in legal limbo. Cosby had broken barriers as the first black actor to star in a network show, I Spy, in the 1960s, and, 2 decades later, created the top-ranked Cosby Show. He also found success with his Fat Albert animated TV show and starred in commercials for Jell-O pudding. But it was Cosby's reputation as a public moralist who urged young people to pull up their saggy pants and start acting responsibly that prompted a federal judge to unseal portions of an explosive deposition he gave more than a decade ago as part of Constand's civil lawsuit against him. Under questioning from her lawyer, Cosby acknowledged that he had obtained several prescriptions for Quaaludes in the 1970s for the purpose of offering the powerful sedative to women he wanted to have sex with. Cosby also said he gave Constand 3 half-tablets of the cold and allergy medicine Benadryl to help her relax before what he insisted was a consensual sexual encounter at his home. Prosecutors suggested he drugged her with something stronger. The jurors clearly struggled with their verdict, telling the judge on Thursday they were at impasse. Judge Stephen O'Neill instructed them to keep working toward a unanimous decision. On Saturday, they came back and told O'Neill they were hopelessly deadlocked. The judge sought to comfort the jurors, at least one of whom fought back tears, calling their epic deliberation one of the more courageous acts, one of the more selfless acts that I've seen in the justice system. "I feel bad for all of you, I really do." He reminded prosecutors and the defense that a mistrial is neither vindication nor victory for anybody. It wasn't immediately known how many jurors wanted to convict and how many wanted to acquit. None of the jurors commented after the trial ended and headed home to the Pittsburgh area, some 300 miles, 480 kilometers, from the courthouse outside Philadelphia. Former federal prosecutor David Weinstein said Cosby's celebrity almost certainly played a role in the jury's deliberations, perhaps to convince 2 or 3 jurors that it's impossible to convict Dr. Huxtable, to convict Fat Albert, that he couldn't have done this horrible thing. Constant, now 44, initially went to police about a year after she said Cosby assaulted her, but a prosecutor declared her case too weak to bring charges. A decade later, another district attorney reopened the investigation after his lurid deposition became public, and dozens of women came forward against one of the most beloved stars in all of show business. Cosby was charged shortly before the statute of limitation was set to expire. Bruce Castor, the ex-prosecutor who passed on Constan's case in 2005, said Saturday that he was disappointed but not surprised in Steele's failure to win a conviction. "My opinion continues to be that Ms. Constan was probably the victim of a sexual assault," said Castor, whom Constan is suing for defamation. "Probably does not win criminal trials."
USS Fitzgerald collision likely caused by human error, not tech. By David Z. Morris. The U.S. Navy's USS Fitzgerald struck the Philippine container ship ACX Crystal near Japan on Saturday morning, leaving the destroyer seriously damaged and at least seven sailors missing. According to one expert, there's a good chance the collision was caused by the errors of human crew, despite the presence of onboard systems intended to prevent deadly collisions at sea. Tom Dyer, a naval expert who spoke to Wired, says it's likely both the U.S. Navy vessel and the container ship carried radar-based collision avoidance systems. Much like the systems in advanced automobiles, these systems are designed not only to see a ship's surrounding, but also to calculate whether it's headed for a crash. "It's possible those alert systems failed," Dyer says, "but it's far more likely a human pilot or captain in one of those ships made one or more missteps that proved impossible to correct." "Maneuvering vessels of this size is not easy," Dyer told Wired, "and they don't respond quickly if someone makes a mistake. The area where the collision took place, southwest of Yokosuka Naval Base, is near the heavily trafficked shipping lanes that leads to Tokyo Bay. The complexity of the decision-making required to safely navigate such congestion is part of why shipping companies and researchers, including Giant Maersk, are exploring the potential of more robust computer guidance systems or even fully autonomous ships." Cuban ambassador to the U.S. criticizes President Trump's policy rollbacks. By Eric Jenkins. The Cuban ambassador to the United States trolled President Donald Trump Friday after Trump's announcement of rollbacks on Obama-era policies. Hashtag Cuba, now it is official. These are the new enemies of U.S. foreign policy. Watch out. Jose Ramon Cabanas wrote in a now-deleted tweet that included a picture of what appears to be a family of tourists walking by a street vendor, according to The Hill. Trump's reversal will reinstate a number of travel and commercial restrictions between the U.S. and Cuba. "We will not be silent in the face of communist oppression any longer," Trump said during his speech in Little Havana, Miami. "Effective immediately, I am canceling the last administration's completely one-sided deal with Cuba. Under the new regulations, Americans will no longer be able to take private trips to the island, and U.S. companies and citizens will be barred from doing business with entities controlled by Cuban government agencies, including its military and security services. We do not want U.S. dollars to prop up a military monopoly that exploits and abuses the citizens of Cuba," Trump said. "Americans can still travel to the island under educational pretenses under the new regulations, but they'll be held to strict rules and must record activity logs and schedules to ensure they aren't traveling for the sake of tourism."
Why California's climate change fight is also about public health. By Justin Warland. Even before President Donald Trump pulled the United States out of the Paris Agreement, California Governor Jerry Brown loved to talk about climate change and his efforts to create what he calls the most integrated policy to deal with climate change of any political jurisdiction in the Western Hemisphere. But in California, addressing climate change isn't just about saving the world from rising sea levels, intense heat, and extreme weather events. Environmental policy experts say the state's aggressive global warming program will also help solve a long-standing public health problem. Thanks to its sprawling cities, heavy reliance on cars, and an enormous agriculture industry, California has long been among the most polluted states in the nation. Today, 8 out of 10 Californians live in a county with toxic air that contributes to a range of health problems, such as asthma, heart disease, and even lung cancer. The connection is straightforward. The same sources of emissions that cause global warming also produce pollutants that damage human health. Targeting those sources, like power plants, factories, and vehicles, fights climate change and also improves human health. And no place in the country stands to benefit more than California. In California, we need to address our climate pollution problem, and we need to address our air quality problem, says Adrian Martinez, an attorney at the environmental law firm Earth Justice, who works on clean air enforcement. The goals go hand in hand. We need to drastically decrease the amount of fossil fuels we combust. But actually tackling the public health problem in California comprehensively has, until recently, seemed like a far-off goal. While the state has moved away from the coal-fired power plants that harm human health and contribute to global warming, rampant pollution from the transportation sector has remained difficult to solve. Large cities with little public transportation mean millions of residents drive dozens of miles every day simply to go to work, take children to school, and run basic errands. Those who do take mass transit largely rely on buses, which produce their own air pollution. Nor does Mother Nature do the state any favors. Pollution collects in the valleys and basins that house population centers and tends to stay there because of the relatively low amount of wind and rain. For years, California has tried to curb the harmful emissions on its roads. In 1990, California established a reduction program, and to this day, the state is the only in the nation to issue its own emission standards for passenger vehicles. That has a ripple effect, since more than a dozen states have chosen to enforce California's rule, and car makers generally introduce a single model that can meet standards across the nation. In the more than 25 years since California launched its program, the prospect of embracing zero emissions vehicles on a large scale has become increasingly possible. In places without California's pollution problem, global warming has led policymakers to move away from the internal combustion engine. A range of countries, from Norway to China, have set electric vehicle targets. And, with the writing on the wall, automakers have pushed ahead with technological advances to meet the demand. Passenger vehicles, shipping, buses, if you add up all of the sources on wheels, they really are the greatest opportunity, says Sean Hecht, who runs a Center on Environmental Law at the University of California, Los Angeles. With this transition in mind, leaders in California have set ambitious targets for moving to electric vehicles. An executive order signed by Brown in 2012 calls for 1.5 million zero-emission vehicles by 2025, and the state has funded infrastructure initiatives meant to advance the goal. L.A. is kind of the perfect place to become the electric vehicle capital of the world. We have lots of passenger vehicles. We have lots of transit buses, says Martinez. Electrification of our transportation sector is critical. Review: Rough Night exposes the threadbare downside of the women cutting loose genre, by Stephanie Zacharick. It's hard enough being a woman filmmaker these days, but consider the plight of the woman film goer. It took years to get a big budget Wonder Woman vehicle, and if you really must have role models in your movies, she's probably not a bad one. But comedies in which women behave really badly, like 2016's Bad Moms or Absolutely Famous the Movie, or the most recent Snatched, have become the happy hour Cosmo of movie going. They're plentiful and supposedly just the ticket for women looking for a girls' night out picture, just something fun to see for kicks. But if they're supposed to be just a diversion, why, one after another, do they torture us with so many questions? Am I supposed to like this? Is this supposed to be funny? Does this really represent what Hollywood thinks most, or even just many, or some women really want from big screen entertainment? Rough Night, directed and co-written by Lucia Aniello, who has also written and directed numerous episodes of Broad City, is the latest entry in the women whooping it up genre, and it doesn't make any of the above questions easier to answer. The movie, co-written by Paul Downs, Aniello's boyfriend and writing partner, who also appears in the picture, is at its best when it catches the precise cross-current between sleazy and breezy. Scarlett Johansson is Jess, who's launching a bid for state senator. She's also about to be married, an adventure that just might be scarier than running for public office. Her old college clique, hoity-toity real estate diva Blair, Zoe Kravitz, kooky activist Frankie, Alana Glazer of Broad City, and randy insecure teacher Alice, Jillian Bell, are spiriting her off to Miami for one last bachelorette weekend. They don't know that she has also invited Pippa, Kate McKinnon, a college friend they don't know. Jess met her while spending a year abroad. Pippa is Australian, a loopy good time girl with an Earth Mother streak, and her accent is a wild ocean of exaggerated rolling vowels. She barges into the movie in an assortment of tropical printed rompers and maxi dresses, and she gets the movie's best lines, or maybe she only makes them the best, unreeling them like crazy colored party streamers. The opening third of Rough Night is the best part of the movie and also the most predictable. The women get to Miami and commence partying, hard, immediately. Why is it funny when Frankie scores some coke and the women, at first reluctant to partake, one of them is running for public office after all, end up descending upon it like gulls fighting for a scrap of fruit on a beach? Somehow the loose, coarse nuttiness of it works. There are props, including funny glasses with a fake penis where the nose should be. There's a male stripper. Make that two male strippers, at least in the literal sense that two brawny guys end up stripping down. But when the movie takes a sort of dark turn into black comedy territory, it starts to fall apart. The new, supposedly outrageous scenarios just aren't as funny as the stock women-gone-wild gags. Ty Burrell and Demi Moore show up in tiny roles as a kinky, predatory couple, but their oily come-ons are more limp than they are slippery. The idea behind Rough Night isn't bad by itself, and it's fun to watch Johansson cutting loose in a comedy for a change. The picture also offers a few sight gags that are pure dumb genius. They just work. The sight of Downs as Jess's fiancé gingerly and acrobatically polishing the windshield of an 18-wheeler, did I mention he's wearing a diaper, isn't something you're likely to forget soon. But Rough Night tries hard to capture the pleasurably profane, uncorked spirit of Broad City and doesn't quite succeed, maybe because the joys of the show lie in how casual and intimate it is. Its glimpses into believable neurotic behavior among women are larkish and offhand, but blown up for the big screen, they're not quite enough to fill it. I laughed a few times at Rough Night, often at McKinnon, and at least once at Downs in his diaper. And really, as hangover-style dumb entertainments go, it's certainly good enough, which isn't to say it's anything close to what women want. Apple iPad Pro versus Microsoft Surface Pro. Which tablet is right for you? By Lisa Idichico. If there's one image that comes to mind when choosing between an Apple and Microsoft product, it's probably actors Justin Long and John Hodgman standing alongside one another against a white backdrop. "We use a lot of the same kinds of programs," says Hodgman, playing the role of a PC dressed in a beige business jacket and slacks in one iconic Get a Mac ad from 2006. "But we retain a lot of what makes us us." Fast forward more than 10 years later, and little about that sentiment has changed. Both Microsoft and Apple have recently launched new tablets that they say are designed for productivity and creativity. The fifth-generation Surface Pro, launching on Thursday and starting at $799, is the company's fastest model yet, with Microsoft claiming longer battery life, better performance, and more accurate stylus input. Apple unveiled a new iPad Pro just last week, which has an updated processor, a new size option, and improved screen technology. The 10.5-inch version starts at $649, while the 12.9-inch size begins at $799. Both are powerful, portable, and expensive machines designed to fulfill similar roles, each excelling and falling short in their own ways. The iPad Pro functions better as a tablet overall, while the Surface Pro is more capable of replacing your PC. That's largely because of the software powering these devices. The iPad Pro runs on iOS, which boasts a massive library of more than 2 million apps, many of which are optimized specifically for the iPad. You can feel comfortable knowing that when a popular app launches, there's a good chance it will be available for the iPad and it'll look good. Meanwhile, Microsoft has long been criticized for its smaller selection of apps, which is part of the reason its mobile platform never took off. Spotify and YouTube are two popular apps still missing from the Windows Store, for example. The desktop experience is where the Surface has a sizable lead over the iPad Pro. Yes, Apple is making an effort to turn the iPad into a better laptop replacement. When iOS 11 launches in the fall, the iPad will gain a dock that holds more apps, a redesigned app switcher, and a new file management app, all of which make it more like a real computer. Even before that update, the iPad Pro can display apps in a split-screen view, minimize a video, and play it in the corner so you can continue with other tasks and pull up apps in a sidebar. But the Surface runs full-fledged Windows 10, making it better equipped for multitasking right out of the gate. That's the biggest advantage the Surface has over the iPad. If you've been using Windows at all in the past few years, you already know how it works. Plus, you can use a mouse with the Surface Pro, which is tremendously helpful for precision. For getting serious work done, I prefer Microsoft's Signature Type Cover, $159.99 for Signature, $129.99 for regular, over Apple's Smart Keyboard, $169 for 12.9-inch, $159 for 10.5-inch. The Type Cover is more spacious, with plenty of room to rest your palms, a full row of function keys, and a sturdier design than in years past. It still doesn't feel like a laptop keyboard when you're using it in your lap rather than on a hard surface, but it's enough to get the job done. The iPad's keyboard cover is adequate if you're taking a few notes or sending quick emails, but it's too cramped to use for a full workday. Both Apple and Microsoft are marketing their tablets as ideal for creative professionals. With that in mind, both have engineered their own styluses for everything from taking notes to editing photos and sketching artwork. Both the Apple Pencil, $99, and Surface Pen, $59.99 for regular, $99.99 for platinum, are responsive and fluid, but I prefer Microsoft's for two reasons. It magnetically attaches to the Surface so it's harder to lose, and it can simply do more than the Apple Pencil. Clicking the Surface Pen's top button pulls up a side panel on the tablet with apps designed for stylus input, like Sticky Notes and Sketchpad, as well as suggested apps. The Apple Pencil works well, but doesn't provide any additional functionality, and there's nowhere to store it. The Surface Pro has another design advantage over the iPad Pro, too, the kickstand. It makes it possible to adjust the viewing angles to your liking and prop up the Surface on a table or desk even when it's not connected to its keyboard case. The kickstand on the newest model is even more flexible, allowing the Surface to lie nearly flat against a table similar to a drafting board. In terms of hardware, both the Surface Pro and iPad Pro are equipped with gorgeous screens, zippy processors, and pretty good battery life. But there are some important differences. Although the Surface Pro's screen, 12.3 inches with a resolution of 2736 by 1824, and the 10.5-inch iPad Pro's display, 2224 by 1668 resolution, both looked sharp and colorful when streaming video side by side, the iPad was better suited for reading. This is mostly thanks to Apple's True Tone technology, which softened the blue light coming from the screen to feel easier on the eyes. Scrolling is also smoother on Apple's tablet, although the difference is only noticeable when quickly flipping through content. But Microsoft gives buyers more options when it comes to processing power. Surface shoppers can customize their machine with a lower-powered Intel M3 or desktop-class Core i5 or Core i7, all of which are new 7th-generation processors. Microsoft also offers up 1 terabyte of storage space, while all iPad Pro models run on Apple's A10X Fusion chip and have a maximum of 512 gigabytes of storage space. Still, both machines offer speedy and smooth performance and can multitask with ease. On both the iPad Pro and Surface Pro, I worked on spreadsheets, wrote articles, opened nearly 20 tabs in Google Chrome, played games with heavy graphics, and streamed video without any stutters. The Surface Pro scored slightly higher in performance tests designed to measure speed when it comes to running apps and processing images, but not by much. However, I did notice that Microsoft's tablet began to feel warm to the touch while it ran a full system virus scan in the background of those tasks. Because I chose to use Google Chrome during the course of this test, which gobbled up 80% of my battery usage, the Surface Pros didn't last quite as long as I had expected. I got about 6 hours out of the device, which might not be enough to get through a full workday without plugging in. If you don't mind primarily using Microsoft's Edge browser, you'll likely get much more mileage out of the device. But the iPad still lasted longer. After using a mix of Chrome and Safari, I only burned through a quarter of the battery after 3.5 hours. If you're trying to decide whether a Surface Pro or iPad Pro is right for you, the answer largely depends on your preferences and how you plan to use it. The iPad Pro has a better selection of polished apps, is lighter and more portable, and is better for reading. In my experience, it's plenty powerful enough to keep up with devices running on the latest Intel processors. But the software just isn't there yet if you often plan to use it as a laptop replacement. The Surface Pro's Windows 10 support, integrated kickstand, and superior accessories make it better at functioning as a work computer, but its app selection needs work. Think of it this way. The iPad Pro is the device I choose to take on a long car ride, especially if I want to catch up on a lot of work-related reading, fire off some emails, and squeeze in some gaming. The Surface Pro is the computer I toss in my bag on the way to a conference to publish stories or bring to a meeting to manage notes. Perhaps Justin Long, dressed in a t-shirt and jeans as the Mac, puts it best. "You should see what this guy can do with a spreadsheet," he says in the ad, gesturing toward his PC counterpart. "It's insane." How Helmut Kohl Wanted to Be Remembered by Lily Rothman. In July of 1990, about a half a year after the fall of the Berlin Wall, Helmut Kohl, the German politician who has died Friday at 87, was then chancellor and met with Mikhail Gorbachev at a resort in the Russian countryside. With the wall toppled, a thaw was in Europe's political air, but the shape of what was to come was still hazy and unsettled. What would a world with a reunified Germany look like? After a few days of talk, the two leaders announced that they had figured out the answer and that it was a hopeful compromise that would allow resolution to move ahead at full speed. President George H.W. Bush was surprised by how quickly they were able to come to that agreement, but pleasantly so. Kohl's rise to power was somewhat rocky. When he became Chancellor of West Germany in 1982, Time noted that he faced vigorous opposition inside his country and that his rise came out of weeks of virtual paralysis and political infighting. But the 1990 announcement was seen as proof that he had become one of the world's most successful diplomatic players. In a story about the agreement, accompanied by a cover that called him Mr. Germany, Time expressed optimism about how he would use that talent and captured the leader's hope that he would one day be remembered for it. Kohl understands the visceral suspicion of Germany among its neighbors and says, "I cannot deny our history." At the same time, he insists that it's time to recognize how much Germany and the world have changed. Kohl was 15 when the war ended. He calls himself the first chancellor of the post-Hitler generation, and he firmly believes a little patriotism without nationalism would be good for the country. As early as 1976, when Cole made his first run for chancellor, he said one of his ambitions was to work with foreign leaders to bring about a more normal relationship with the Germans. On his first visit to Moscow in July 1983, he asked Kremlin leader Yuri Andropov, "What would you say as a Soviet patriot if Moscow and the USSR were divided?" A return to normality has been his constant theme. "I am strictly against having Germany singled out," he said in a Time interview last month. After Kohl came back from the Soviet Union last week, he was asked how it felt to be the man of the hour. "When people come to write about my period of office," he replied, "I would be very happy if they say that I made a contribution to finding the happy medium again for the Germans." He summed himself up in that one sentence. He has no driving ideology and no grand visions other than that Germany must be unified and anchored peacefully inside Europe. He really is the German everyman striving for the utopia of ordinariness, says Robert Leicht, political commentator for the Hamburg Weekly Die Zeit. "I often disagree with Kohl, but I take it for granted he is a harmonizer. His whole life is dominated by the idea that we must fit in the framework. It makes him a man who deserves to be trusted." And more than a quarter century later, as the world remembers Kohl, his wish has largely been granted. His time in office and his life in general has remained largely defined by his role in uniting Germany and thus helping to bring the Cold War to a close. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.